welcome to the AdLib podcast, where we interview industry professionals and get an insight into the theatre world.
I'm Henry.
And I'm Jessie.
And we're back. We're back after a short break, but now as an independent podcast. Isn't that exciting?
Yeah, very exciting. Woo!
Yeah, it's all a bit different now. So we've moved away from York Theatre Royal. Like, amazing.
Who we love.
Who we absolutely adore. Because sadly, me and Jessie are no longer based in York, which is actually really upsetting. We've both graduated.
Yeah, we're not going to give you our addresses, though.
Yeah, no. But yeah, so but because of the worldwide situation, we're still doing interviews. We're now doing them via video call. So thankfully, I haven't had to see Jessie in person since February.
You have seen my face on your laptop, though.
Many times.
For a ridiculous amount of time this year, though.
So quite I'm unfortunately, sorry about that. Yeah. So we've already been cracking on with interviews over the past few months, I think it is now. Time is meaningless at this point. But we've got some great guests coming your way, including in this episode, the wonderful Oscar Conlon Murray, who is actor and extraordinaire, who in an alternative universe where theatres are still open because of there isn't a worldwide pandemic, he would be in Only Fools and Horses at the Haymarket Theatre.
Oscar chats to us about drama school, about how important AmDram is, and just general sort of post-pandemic Twitter madness. Grab yourself a cup of tea. Unlikely to be on a commute, but if you are, then keep your mask over your nose and enjoy the episode.
And now we're joined by Oscar Conlon Murray. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, cherubs. This is marvellous.
How are you?
I am stonkingly marvellous. I am holed up in my little gay grotto in North London. Enjoying a Malbec and seeing your lovely faces.
Where else would you want to be? That's magical.
Where else is there, Jessie? I can't think of anywhere.
I mean, these days, like, our houses, that's about it, really.
It really is. It really is. I'm just very grateful to have this little studio sanctuary.
Can you, for the listeners who, for whatever reason, don't know who you are, can you introduce yourself and what you do?
Of course, yes. Everyone hates this question. I am Oscar Conlon Murray, and I am a musical theatre performer, known for my work mainly on the West End, doing Toxic Avenger, and Nativity, the musical, and more recently, Only Fools and Horses, Death Musicale. That's it, really. There's nothing else to me.
Perfect. Well, what was your... Before all these wonderful roles happened, what was your route into the industry?
Well, I kind of took quite a classic route, really. I went to drama school. I went to Mount View Academy of Theatre Arts and left and very luckily went straight into my first job, which was in the West End in The Toxic Avenger. So, yeah, that was kind of my route in, was through drama school. I did try for a number of years to get into drama school. I first did a lot of amateur dramatics, which is kind of poo-pooed a little bit in our industry. And I find that quite insulting, because I think AmDram is such an institution in this country and is... genuinely one of the very best formative stomping grounds you can have, because it teaches you so much about the actual practicality of being an actor, but more than that, it teaches you how to be a company member and to enjoy the work, which is ultimately how the best work is made. So I'm a massive exponent of amateur dramatics, and that's where we met, of course, Henry, all those years ago.
15 years ago, we were both in the production of Oliver at the Palace Theatre with Newark Operatic Society. And now we're here. Who'd have thought?
Glorious. I did love that show, actually. I loved it. It was such a high budget, wasn't it, for an AmDram show?
Yeah, they were always pretty good, because I did the year before, because my parents were in it, and I got dragged in as the small child at the end of MAME. Who came on and said a few swear words, which I didn't understand at the time.
Oh, but you loved that.
And then
that.
stayed on and did Oliver, and wasn't quite the title role as you were, But I was one of Fagin's gang, which was... It was a lot of fun, I do remember that.
But you had one of the best lines, Henry. Can you give it to us now?
Do I have to do the complete accent as well?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, wonderful. It was... These sausages are mouldy.
Yes!
Yeah.
Shut up and drink your tea.
Someone cast me.
So, Oscar, you mentioned going to drama school to Mountview. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like? What those, was it 3 years were like at drama school?
Yeah, it was 3 years. Drama school is one of those things that you either look back on and absolutely adore, or you look back on and say, that was the hardest 3 years of my life. Because it is. It's incredibly difficult. And you're challenged on every level, intellectually, emotionally. My remembrance, looking back on it, is one of pure joy. I had the most wonderful time. And, you know, they say that you make your friends for life when you're in your 20s. And I did. And it was all... thanks to drama school that I've taken this little chosen family and now see them, not currently, but usually, as often as I can. So yes, it was hard. There's no getting away from that. But it was exactly the introduction to this career that I needed. So yeah, and the wonderful thing about Mountview is that it doesn't necessarily... give you a skill set and say, okay, this is what you're going to do. It rather gives you the skills to be able to apply to cultivate yourself as an artist and for you to be able to say, okay, I'm going to take this, I'm going to leave that, I'm going to hone this skill and I'm going to create my brand and who I am and what I do well and take it on and apply it to this job and that job and make a name for myself in that field, which is what I found incredibly useful from it.
So when you stepped out of drama school, you were almost instantly on the West End. How did that happen?
Well, it was an audition, really. The wonderful thing about drama school in London is that you are in the epicentre of everything and people are keeping a beady eye out for who's graduating so that they can... then use new people and new blood for different projects. And I was... I think I was just doing A Midsummer Night's Dream, playing Bottom. and someone came along, a casting director came along. I can't recall who it was now. But they saw me and then I got an audition through for The Toxic Avenger based on that performance. And it just worked perfectly that as soon as I graduated, in fact, the actual graduation ceremony I ran to, did it, and then ran straight back to the theatre and went on stage that night. So it was really straight in, which was wonderful. But yeah, it was an audition like any other at that point. And I wasn't hopeful for it because I was a new grad and, you know, it's not always that people are willing to give a new grad a chance. But they did with me, which I'm very, very grateful for because it was a wonderful show to be a part of and has given me a lot of opportunities after the fact. So, yeah.
Did you have an agent at that point?
At that point, yes, I must have done because my agent cast me after seeing A Midsummer Night's Dream. So, yeah, I signed with Bobby Chat at Global Artists, who is just the most gorgeous human being on this planet. And that's very important, you know, to when you get to the stage where you are looking for agents, it has to be a relationship where you click with someone because you are effectively working for each other. So, yeah, I was very, very lucky out of drama school to kind of land my forever agent, although she's not because she's now left agenting. She's abandoned me, bless her, to go and see... Pastures New.
What's it like joining a show like Toxic? And then I suppose moving on to sort of Only Fools and Nativity where you're doing a long run. How do you feel about signing up for a project knowing that you could be doing this for 8 shows a week for what could be a year?
Well, Of course, for the bank account, it's gorgeous, darling. I mean, there's no surety or stability, really, in this profession. So when you do land a long run, it's a wonderful thing. But from a creativity perspective, you have to be very careful about what jobs you choose to take, if you are in a position to be able to choose. Purely because, you know, these new shows that I've done have meant that I've been able to actually create things and offer things, yeah. And originate things, which is wonderful for me because it fuels that creative spark. But if you are going into a long-standing show, some of the more commercial shows, it is a little bit more like, right, well, you're going to stand on number three because that's how the lighting designer organised it, yeah. back in the 80s. Which isn't quite as creatively fulfilling. There's still tricks and things you can do to make it so, but doesn't quite get me as excited as original work does.
So just going off that, how, like, for someone who wouldn't know, when you step into a show that is not an original, that has got, like you said, someone in the 80s decided where you would stand in that moment, how do those rehearsals... What do they look like compared to ones where you're coming in completely fresh? Are they totally different?
They wouldn't look totally different, but the way that they run are, there's often a lot less time to rehearse in a more commercial, long-standing show because you will end up doing quite a few show watches prior, so you can actually see how people are doing it in the outgoing cast and then work on your... imagining of the character with the director or resident director, usually, if it is an incoming cast. The difference with original work is that you cultivate. You often have the writers in the room. You are permitted to play. And if you do play and the writer enjoys it, then it's quite possible that part will grow or expand or change or differ, or a line that you ad-lib podcast, will be included in the script itself. So, yeah, there are a lot of differences. But I suppose the main one is the length of time that you're given to rehearse it in.
You've had experience with Nativity. You stepped into an existing show there and were also an understudy. What was that like for you, particularly understudying such a popular character? Me and Jesse are both big Nativity fans, just for context.
Absolutely. Here. Nativity is... I said it last week to Henry, the best British film, I mean film as well as musical, that has been made for ever.
It's very special. And you know what? I don't consider Nativity to necessarily be a show that already existed prior to me going in, purely because the director, Debbie is it, who is just... the most terrifying director you can ever imagine, and equally really? The most gorgeous human being in the world. I remember the audition process so vividly. So I walked in, and she was sat behind this desk, and she said, "Okay, this is point A." So, for example, Mr. Poppy has just been told that Hollywood are going to come and see the Nativity. And this is point B, when Mr. Poppy has convinced the whole school that Hollywood are coming and that we have to get this nativity ready. And she says, "Okay, those are your two points, A and B, off you go." And then you're stranded as an actor with absolutely no ideas of where to go. And you just have to get from point A to point B, ad-libbing, improving. And then whatever you end up doing, some of it is kept, some of it isn't. Debbie will sit there stony-faced and go, "You're boring me." And so you have to quickly change on a dime and do something totally different. And that's very intimidating, but that's the kind of energy that I love, to actually have that pressure cooker atmosphere of having to create something as quickly as you possibly can. That setup was very, very different, because it did feel like it was an original piece. Because anything that I was doing gags when I went on as Mr. Poppy, I was doing gags about Weight Watchers and all these Weight Watchers meetings I was missing, and various things that Simon Lipkin, who I was understudying, didn't didn't use. And Simon was brilliant for that as well, because he was very adamant that I made the character my own, and said to me, before I first went on, my first show was at the, as Mr. Poppy, was at the Liverpool Empire, which is a huge venue. It's something like 4,500 people. It's massive. Might be less than that. I'm exaggerating. But I was in front of all these people, and he'd said, just before I went on, he said, I want 6 new gags. And so I had to create 6 new things that he hadn't put in. And that's joyous for me as a, an entertainer, as a clown, as a comedian. That's where the creativity lies and that spark lies. So yeah, Nativity was a different beast.
I'm panicking. Like, do you ever have a moment where it's something doesn't land, where you're ad-libbing and it's not funny?
Yes, all the time. And Jesse, the joyous thing for me is that when that happens, makes me laugh. So if I'm not making them laugh, at least I'm making myself laugh, because when I attempt a gag and it doesn't land, that's me gone. That's just the funniest thing in the world. And then you just regroup and do another one. There's no point ever being hurt by it, or if something doesn't land, questioning whether you're doing it right. I mean, you're not. If it doesn't land, you're not doing it right, and that's fine. Try again.
That's wonderful. So have there been any sort of particular highlights for you with sort of across these sort of 3 West End shows?
Highlights a difficult word, because they've all been highlights in their time. I've never had a show where I've just loathed every second of it. I would probably say Only Fools and Horses, meeting these people that I have, you know, looked up to in the world of comedy for so long, you know, having Ricky Gervais for drinks and Hugh Laurie and Matt Lucas and all these amazing people who have kind of carved their paths in comedy, and that I've always admired and wanted to pay homage in a way to their trailblazing. That's been very, very special. Working with Paul Whitehouse as well. And I mean, watching these people in their own creative ventures, like Paul and Bob Mortimer doing the Gone Fishing show, it's very, very special, because you feel intrinsically like you're part of a much bigger entertainment picture. That's probably a highlight, working with those people.
On the flip side of that, have you had any unexpected challenges that you wouldn't have foreseen in this career path?
Yes, every day. Every day. I mean, there's been one quite large one recently. I don't know if you've heard of the coronavirus. But that's been terribly challenging. There are always things that challenge you, particularly if you are doing 8 shows a week, if you're doing a particularly demanding role, as mine was in Toxic Avenger and Only Fools and Horses. You know, vocal health and stability of keeping everything going is hard, particularly when you're a big girl like me. You know, you've got to juggle health and fitness alongside making sure that you are giving the best show you can possibly give, and not losing too much weight so that the wardrobe department have to take everything in and hate you. There are untold challenges, but one of the gorgeous things about it is that you're not forewarned about them, so you do entirely craft your art. Oh god, that's wanky. Around those challenges and around trying to overcome those battles and struggles, and that's a joyous thing. And I would never say to anyone, I would never give anyone a wealth of advice and say, do this, don't do this, because you have to experience it yourself and find who you are and what works for you as an individual.
So you were nominated for Best Supporting Actor in a Musical for the What's on Stage Awards. Firstly, congratulations.
Thank you.
What did that feel like to be formally recognised for a role that you'd helped create?
I mean, it was gorgeous. It was gorgeous because there are so many award bodies, you know, the Oliviers and various others. But this one stands alone as being entirely judged by our audience and by the demographic of people that we are trying to entertain. And that is what an actor can never lose. I mean, I said I wouldn't give advice, but I'm giving some. All of this, everything that we do is for the audience and has to be. As soon as you start putting your own ego at the centre or considering your work to be above that, you're losing sight of why we do it. You know, we are entertainers. We are the people that hold a mirror up to society and go, is this what you want? And for the audience to recognise me in that way was incredibly humbling. And yeah, I was a little bit overwhelmed, to be honest.
How has social media played a role in your career?
Well, do you know what? Up until recently, I wouldn't say it had at all. Because I'm not terribly good with social media. And I'm a bit anachronistic in that I like antiques and living in a, you know, room full of old things and reading books. So the world of social media has always been a little bit alien to me, particularly because it's it can either be a place that spurs creativity and joy, or at the other end of the scale, can be a really divisive, cruel community, if you can use that word in inverted commas. But on the day that we heard Only Fools and Horses was closing due to Corona, we, as any cast would, decided to go and get absolutely pissed at the local pub. I mean, we didn't, give us some slack, we didn't know what Corona really was at the time. We were allowed in pubs back then. And we got absolutely smashed. And it was that night that I ended up on a tube singing, I say singing, shouting, sometimes losing my mind, through a window into the next carriage.
And I've seen it, yeah.
That ended up on Twitter. I say ended up, I was pissed and put it on Twitter. and I woke up, this was on the 16th of March, so I woke up on the next day and I had about 6,000 notifications and I was just shooketh because I never had anything like this before. So I quickly looked through and it was all people saying lovely things about how funny they thought it was. And I was now facing a term of unemployment for an unspecified amount of time. So that quite organically became my avenue for making people laugh and entertaining people when I couldn't on stage. So I think I'm now 30 videos in, and it has just grown and grown, which is gorgeous because it means that I stay connected to my theatre community and at the same time start reaching out to people beyond that. And everything on my social media feed is always positive. You won't find anything even remotely negative because I don't necessarily think Twitter or Facebook or Instagram are the place to air those views. Maybe it is for some people, but for me, it's a place to entertain. And that's my kind of online sanctuary where people can come and they can have a laugh or they can choose not to. It's entirely up to them.
So did you have a blue tick before the virus, or is that a since thing?
Darling, I don't have a blue tick now. I'm furious.
Oh no, sorry, I've put my foot right in it. I thought you did.
I'm Jesse.
You and you, Henry.
I know. Do we know anyone that works at Twitter? Let's sort it out.
I'm sure they're listening.
We'll start a campaign.
We'll put the word out.
Yeah. Can we? Let's do that.
One video that sticks out in particular that was done quite recently was your Hamilton cover. Do you want to talk about how that one particularly came about? Because it involved a lot of guest stars.
It did. So We'll Be Back, I had on working in the background for quite a while. and I was desperately trying to come up with the lyrics, and I tried for about 3 months and I just couldn't do it because Lin-Manuel Miranda's rhyming patterns are so, so ingenious that I was trying to make things fit and I couldn't. And so I put it on the back burner. I said, look, this isn't going to work. It's not going to happen. It was a nice idea, but no. And then we got a press conference with Bojo, bless him, not. And he then said that we were potentially going into a second lockdown. And I was like, right, that's it. I've got to do something. I've got to put something out there that raises spirits a little bit if we are... I mean, at this point, we still thought we were going to open in November in the West End. So I was like, right, this isn't happening. We've got to do something. So I initially sent what awful lyrics I had created to Eamon O'Dwyer, who is this fabulous composer-lyricist that I work with a lot. And I said, can you fix this? And he sent me back the same day the lyrics that are now on the video. And I was like, okay, I think this might have legs. So I messaged Carrie Hope Fletcher and a few other friends and said, darlings, if you have any time whatsoever, could you spare 5 minutes to just record a few da-da-da-da-das for me? And I mean, I'm so, so humbled and lucky that every single one of them turned around and said, yes, absolutely. So then I had all of these fabulous people involved who I've admired for years, and and then it just came to life, which is gorgeous.
I just assume there's a WhatsApp group for all West End performers that you just threw it out on there, but crush my dreams, you know.
Darling, if there is, I've certainly not been invited to it, but maybe maybe in time.
Is there anything else in the pipeline? Have you got anything in the works?
I've got an idea.
Ooh.
I've got an idea for a series of videos over Advent, but I shan't say too much because it might not materialise. No. But yeah, I think it would be very lovely.
So one kind of more, I suppose, serious side of what you've been doing over the pandemic was your silent protests that you helped organise standing outside West End theatres. So would you be able to talk a bit about those as well?
Absolutely, yeah. So the silent protests were, the silent stands rather, were to highlight the plight of everyone who works in the theatre industry. And that's not just the performers who are the kind of front men. That is the front of house staff, the box office, the bar staff, the cleaners, the ushers, the maintenance workers, the stage crew, cast, producers, writers, set designers, directors, lighting, sound engineers, the art department, the production teams, the makeup, wigs, costumes, carpenters, marketing, PR, musicians, MDs. Like, this list is absolutely endless. And it all came about quite impromptu, because I was outside our theatre at the Haymarket. I was just walking past. And I thought, oh, this is a good photo op. So I took a seat outside the steps of the theatre and set up my camera and took a picture and said, I'm not leaving here until they let me back on stage. And then the director of the show, CJ Ranger, who is... You know, there are some people that just get shit done. Well, that's her. Whilst being the most remarkable woman and creatively expert, she is also a doer. So she messaged me and said, I loved that picture and it's given me inspiration to start an idea of a silent stand where we get all the cast in position and we stand for 15 minutes to raise awareness of all these people. And it's a huge, huge group of people that have been affected, because not only is it those people that I've just listed, but it's all the industries around it, the knock-on effect of the cab drivers and the hoteliers and the restaurateurs. You know, this is huge, and everyone that works in hospitality. So that's what we did. We stood for 15 minutes trying to, via the government, to realise that this £1.28 billion industry is viable, and that these 290,000 jobs are worthy of some economic input, which thankfully we got, although now we're not entirely sure where it's gone. But as part of the silent stands, they really took off, and CJ continued, and we had Dawn French, Jennifer Saunders, Beverly Knight, Nika Burns, loads of drag queens recently. We did a drag show in the Haymarket with Velmicelli and various other wonderful performers. So yeah, that's taken off. And the fabulous thing about it is that we were able to use the PR from our show. So we had Paul Whitehouse as the front man, and he, you know, it was in the Guardian, it was in the Times, it was in the tabloid newspapers, and ITV took it up on the news channel. Like, it's really hit where we wanted it to. So that's been part of the activism. But I consider, you know, putting out videos and trying to make people laugh all part of the activism as well. It's trying to make a change on some level, no matter what that is.
Yeah, that's really important.
And you said that you had been expecting to open in November, and then, you know, clearly not legal at the minute. Is there any sort of, do you know when maybe you might next open, and how much do you believe that that is a possibility?
Well, we are taking tickets now from April, and I genuinely believe that's going to happen. Partially because I have to, for my own sanity. But I think April is quite possible, particularly with this talk of a vaccine. I mean, we cannot, as an industry, open with social distancing. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Particularly in small venues like the Haymarket. I mean, it's not small, it's 1,000 seats, but it's old, it's Victorian, you know, it's small corridors, and it's lacking in female toilet facilities, you know what I mean? Like, it's not an ideal place to ventilate. So that's our main issue, and I genuinely believe that we will have the resources in place by April to reopen in some capacity.
Yeah, like you were saying, like, the knock-on effect has just been, like, astounding about how, like, the beating heart of London is the theatre scene, and the musicals. The work you've been doing to push that message out of the people in this massive bubble who know, for people who, yeah, don't work in theatre, that's been really important. So thank you.
No, bless you. Thank you. It's all been very much worth it just to be able to engage with people outside our industry and try and get our message across, because you're right, and there is a kind of ballerinas get to the back of the queue element, which I think our late Mr. Cummings might have come out with muggles and people that aren't involved with musical theatre or indeed any of the arts. But the reality is that these are the same people that have sat and watched Netflix for the whole of lockdown. Yeah. Or listen to the radio, or read a book. We're all part of the same creative industry. Everything fuels everything. Netflix wouldn't exist without theatre. Couldn't. We are the pool of talent and the experimental phase for everything that you see. So, yeah, I mean, getting that message across isn't easy, but it's one that we all kind of have to take on and say, okay, if I tell three people how important this is, maybe that will multiply and get this message across.
Even if that's a retweet, isn't it?
Absolutely. Sharing that message. Absolutely. That's exactly all it needs. I mean, I talked about this double-edged sword of social media, but it is incredibly useful to get information out there to the masses that aren't necessarily in your echo chamber. So yeah, retweet away, darlings.
You have done a project during lockdown, which was First Dates, which was it was filmed and then broadcast. What was that experience like for you, at least being able to work during this crazy time?
But it was gorgeous. It was gorgeous. It was as gorgeous as it was frustrating, because I am through and through a theatre performer. I mean, nuance and subtlety aren't really words in my dictionary. But when you're in front of a camera, that's kind of what you need to employ. I didn't, but you probably should. That said, though, you have massive performances on camera, like Jim Carrey and Robin Williams. But the great thing about First Date was that it was a heightened style. Yeah. So I kind of was comfortable with that. But in terms of the actual job itself, you know, performing again, even with it not being in front of a live audience, just being in a room with creative people and being able to make offers, and that relationship that you have with cast members and the creative team, it's why I do it. So that was incredibly special, and I was very lucky to have been asked to do that. And Lambert Jackson Productions, who produced it, the work they've been doing to give work to performers who aren't working at the moment is just incredible, and they really do deserve the biggest credit for what they've done.
So is there any advice that you'd give your younger self, looking back at the start of your career?
Oh, I kind of touched on this before a little bit.
Yeah.
In that I wouldn't. And the reason I wouldn't is because someone once described it to me as a train journey. So if you get the train from King's Cross to Edinburgh and you focus entirely on that journey, on your destination, on where you want to be, and you don't look out the window on the way, then you miss some of the most beautiful parts of the world and of that journey. You miss Berwick-upon-Tweed, you miss the East Coast, you miss, you know, even where Henry and I are from, you miss Newark in Nottinghamshire, which has some beautiful fields. So
Peterborough.
And Peterborough, exactly. You miss Peterborough. So no, I can't give any advice to anyone, because anyone's journey is going to be far different from mine. And that's the gorgeous thing about it, because that's what informs who you are as a person, who you are as a performer. So the only advice I would ever give is look out the window.
Really like that.
I love that.
That's really sweet.
Keep your eyes open for Peterborough and Newark.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Well, I think that's everything. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Would you like to quickly plug your Twitter so people can enjoy the previous videos and maybe look out for this Advent style videos that might or may not be coming?
I would love to plug my Twitter. Thank you so much, Henry Longstaff. My Twitter, you can find me at @Oscar_C_M_. I don't know why I put the final underscore, but I just feel like it works somehow. It's like it's underlined. I don't know.
And hopefully soon to have a blue tick next to it.
Hopefully. Come on, Twitter.
I will personally be sending an email just to avoid embarrassment.
I appreciate that, Jessie. God bless you.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We enjoyed having you on, and we hope that you enjoy the rest of your glass of wine.
Darling, the glass of wine left this world very long ago. But thank you so much for having me. It's been absolutely glorious, and I love the podcast. So keep up doing what you're doing. Mwah!
Thank you, Oscar, for giving up your time and sort of welcoming us into your beautiful flat. I mean, we could see it. Felt like we were there.
You can catch Oscar in Cinderella, the socially distanced ball, at the Turbine Theatre this December. So would fully recommend that. And hopefully when Only Fools and Horses reopens, you'll be able to catch him and see him there. But that's it from us this week. You can check out our social media at The Adlib Podcast and our website, which is adlibpodcast.co.uk.
And if you're a really keen person, or you've got literally nothing else to do in lockdown, then please do leave us a review on any podcast app, because it really does help. And tell your friends and family. So thank you so much for listening, and we will see you soon.
Bye.